Chapter 10. The Shellacking. Dark Money's Midterm Debut, 2010. As donors gathered in Palm Springs at the end of January for the first Koch summit of 2010, the desert air was full of optimism. It was just a week or two after the special election in Boston, one participant recalled. Feeling was running pretty high. A torrent of contributions from undisclosed donors had helped deliver the surprise election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts earlier that month, making him the first Republican elected to the Senate from the liberal state in 38 years. Organizing much of the cash from behind the scenes had been Sean Noble, who was by then on the payroll of the Kochs. Early on, when many others dismissed Brown as a hopeless long shot, Noble had decided that the payoff would be so rich that backing him was worth the gamble. Brown's victory was calamitous for Obama. By filling the seat that had long been held by Ted Kennedy, the legendary Democrat who had died in August, Brown transformed the balance of power in Congress. The Democrats still held the majority in the Senate, but their loss of one seat crippled their power in one key way. Just as Obama was desperately trying to pass a final version of his health care bill, it deprived the Democrats of the 60-vote minimum necessary to overcome a Republican filibuster. The Democrats were left without the numbers necessary to bring the bill to a new vote. Brown's triumph appeared to be the Affordable Care Act's downfall. Brown hadn't won without a lot of help. The numbers told part of the story. Although Brown was a low-profile Republican state senator, best known for posing nude for Cosmopolitan magazine, he had unexpectedly outspent his Democratic opponent, Martha Coakley, by roughly $8.7 million to $5.1 million during the 6 weeks after the primaries. An unusual amount of this, almost $3 million, had come from shadowy out-of-state nonprofit groups funded by undisclosed donors. Two of the most active of these dark money groups, the American Future Fund and Americans for Job Security, had received large infusions of cash from the mysterious social welfare group that Noble had registered the spring before, based at an Arizona post office box. For months, the post office box, otherwise known as the Center to Protect Patient Rights, had been filling with fistfuls of secret cash from Randy Kendrick and other members of the Koch network in an uphill battle to stop the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Noble had redirected much of this money into the front group spending against Coakley in the Massachusetts special election. The hope was that if Republicans could turn one Senate seat, they could block the health care bill and mortally wound Obama. So when the plan worked, Brown's win electrified the donors. Many felt that they had personally turned the tide on Obamacare. "We thought we had it won," the seminar participant recalled. Obama had been so flummoxed by Brown's election that at a White House senior staff meeting the next morning, he had beseeched his staff accusingly, demanding to know, "What's my narrative? I don't have a narrative." His administration's momentum had been buried in outside money. Lifting the donors' spirits further was the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling, which had been handed down on January 21st, 2 days after Scott Brown's victory in Massachusetts and shortly before the Koch summit. Brown's race now seemed a promising dress rehearsal for even more outside money, which the court had ennobled as free speech. So, as the self-described investors came together to plan for the 2010 midterm elections, they were in a buoyant mood. Sean Noble, looking dashing with a tan, had been elevated by then from merely moderating a panel at the June 2009 summit 6 months earlier to now speaking on one. His congressional staff job and unpaid student loans were remnants of the past. As the website of his political consulting firm proclaimed ebulliently, "It's not what you know, but who you know." The panel discussion was titled "The Opportunity of 2010, Understanding Voter Attitudes and the Electoral Map." Noble spoke optimistically about the healthcare fight, which he believed had awakened a national rebellion. Joining him on the dais were three other men, each representing aspects of the underground political operation that would rout the Democrats in the year ahead. The best known of the panelists was Ed Gillespie, a top national political tactician who had become the chairman of the Republican National Committee in 2003 at the age of 41. Gillespie had made a fortune in lobbying, estimated at as much as $19 million. He was a former Democrat, and the firm he co-founded, Quinn Gillespie & Associates, was bipartisan, more concerned with making deals than political purity. Its clients ranged from Enron, the huge energy company that went scandalously bust, to a healthcare group promoting individual insurance mandates akin to those that Obama's opponents called treasonous. The son of an Irish immigrant, Gillespie, according to Capitol lore, had started out parking cars and worked his way up to the top of Washington's booming influence-peddling industry by dint of his easy affability and quick political instincts. As soon as the court handed down its Citizens United decision, Gillespie grasped its promise. Within weeks, he set out to Texas with his fellow Bush White House alumnus Karl Rove to pitch deep-pocketed oil men at the Dallas Petroleum Club on a plan to fund a new kind of shadow political machine. Instead of giving just to the Republican Party or its candidates and having the size of their donations limited, the high rollers could now legally funnel limitless amounts of cash to outside organizations that Rove and Gillespie were about to create, the two operatives explained. These new groups would act as the privatized auxiliary force Rove had been dreaming of for years. Rove told the money men, "People call us a vast right-wing conspiracy, but we're really a half-assed right-wing conspiracy. Now," he emphasized, "it's time to get serious." Even before the Citizens United decision, Gillespie had been busy. While many other conservatives were despondent during the early months of the Obama administration, when the president's approval ratings were stratospherically high, Gillespie had come up with an ingenious plan to exploit the only opening he could see. With Obama dominating Washington, Gillespie looked to the states. He knew that 2011 was a year in which many state legislatures would redraw the boundaries of their congressional districts based on a new census, a process that only took place once a decade. So he put together an ambitious strategy aimed at a Republican takeover of governorships and legislatures all across the country. Capturing them would enable Republicans to redraw their state's congressional districts in order to favor their candidates. While the mechanics of state legislative races were abstruse and deadly dull to most people, to Gillespie, they were the key to a Republican comeback. It was all conceived sitting in Ed's office in Alexandria, Virginia. It was entirely his vision, Gillespie's associate Chris Jankowski later told Politico. It seems like an obvious strategy now, but you have to turn back the clock to realize how demoralized we all were. He was saying, "Here's something smart we can do." Gillespie called the plan REDMAP, an acronym for the Redistricting Majority Project. To implement it, he took over the Republican State Leadership Committee, RSLC, a nonprofit group that had previously functioned as a catch-all bank account for corporations interested in influencing state laws. All he needed was enough money to put REDMAP into action. By the end of 2010, with the help of million-dollar donations from the tobacco companies Altria and Reynolds, as well as huge donations from Walmart, the pharmaceutical industry, and rich private donors like those at the Koch Summit, the RSLC would have $30 million, three times its Democratic counterpart. "It was 3 yards and a cloud of dust," Gillespie later recalled of his scramble for money. "It was a constant working and working and working, especially at honeypots like the Koch Summit." Joining the panel with Noble and Gillespie was a short, balding figure with a seemingly inexhaustible command of political minutiae. With his North Carolina drawl and his glasses slipping down his nose, he might be mistaken for a Southern shop clerk. But James Arthur Art Pope was actually a shop owner. In fact, the multimillionaire chairman and CEO of Variety Wholesalers, a family-owned discount store conglomerate with hundreds of outlets stretching up and down the Mid-Atlantic and the South. Pope was also a charter member of the Coke Network. A longtime friend and ally, he shared Charles's passion for free market philosophy and credited a summer program he attended at the Cato Institute with exposing him to conservative icons like Hayek and Ayn Rand. After graduating from the Duke School of Law in 1981 and taking over his family's private company, he began to transform the Pope Family Foundation, which had assets of nearly $150 million, into a remarkable political force. In the previous decade, Pope and his family and the Family Foundation had spent more than $40 million in efforts to push American politics to the right. In addition to regularly attending the Koch's secret planning summits, he served on the board of the Koch's main public advocacy group, Americans for Prosperity, as he had on its predecessor, Citizens for a Sound Economy, and had joined forces with the brothers on numerous other political enterprises. Tax records showed that Pope had given money to at least 27 of the groups supported by the Kochs, including organizations opposing environmental regulations, tax increases, unions, and campaign spending limits. Pope, like the DeVos family, was a supporter of the James Madison Center for Free Speech. Indeed, Pope's role in his home state of North Carolina was in many respects a state-sized version of the Koch's role nationally. While he wasn't well known outside the state, his growing influence at home had led the Raleigh News and Observer to begin calling him the Knight of the Right. What Pope brought to the panel that weekend was the chance for donors to help him turn North Carolina into a laboratory for REDMAP. Historically, North Carolina had been a pivotal swing state. It was both the face of the New South and the stomping ground of Jesse Helms's race-baiting National Congressional Club. But Obama had carried it narrowly in 2008 and remained popular in 2010. Democrats also dominated the state legislature. The Republicans hadn't controlled both houses of the North Carolina General Assembly for more than 100 years. Not since General Sherman, the joke went. Winning a legislative majority in 2010 wouldn't be easy, but no one was better situated than Pope to make it happen. He was both a master of arcane election law and had a fortune that few individuals could match. But like the Kochs and the DeVosses, he had had little luck over the years persuading voters to follow his lead. While he had served in the state legislature in North Carolina, he had been soundly defeated when he ran for lieutenant governor in 1992, his one bid for statewide office. "He was a terrible candidate," recalled Bob Geary, a political reporter for the Indy Week, an alternative newspaper in Durham who covered the race. "I've never seen him smile. He was very introverted and pedantic." With the precision he was known for, Pope admitted, "I'm not a charismatic stump speaker." Flipping the state would require political artistry and some guile. For this, the panel turned to its fourth member, Jim Ellis. The Kochs were notoriously picky about who received coveted invitations to their summits, but didn't seem to mind that he was under indictment at the time for violating campaign finance regulations. Ellis, an old friend of Noble's, was there to make predictions about the outcome of the 2010 races, but he had other specialties too. Ellis had a history of creating fake movements in support of unpopular corporations and causes. In the 1990s, he had headed a company called Ramhurst, which documents revealed to be a covert public relations arm of R.J. Reynolds, the giant tobacco company. Under his guidance, Ramhurst organized deceptively homegrown-looking smokers' rights protests against proposed regulations and taxes on tobacco. In 1994 alone, R.J. Reynolds funneled $2.6 million to Ramhurst to deploy operatives who mobilized what they called partisans to stage protests against the Clinton healthcare proposal, which would have imposed a stiff tax on cigarette sales. Anti-healthcare rallies that year echoed with cries of, "Go back to Russia." If the outbursts bore a striking resemblance to those against Obama's healthcare proposal 15 years later, It may be because the same political operatives were involved in both. Two of Ellis's former top aides at Ramhurst, Doug Goodyear and Tom Sinhorst, went on in 1996 to form DCI Group, the public relations firm that was helping Noble foment Tea Party protests against the Affordable Care Act. Ellis, meanwhile, had moved into the heart of Washington's Republican money stream. He became what some news reports described as the right-hand man to Tom DeLay, the powerful House Republican leader from Texas who was infamous for his K Street operation, which serviced corporate lobbyists while shaking them down for campaign contributions. DeLay made him executive director of his political action committee. The duo's high-handed approach resulted in both men getting indicted for campaign finance violations in 2005. In time, DeLay's conviction was overturned, but Ellis was less lucky. In 2012, he pleaded guilty to a single felony count and paid a fine. Undaunted, he airbrushed DeLay's name from his corporate resume and kept on. Asked about his career in manufacturing protests for pay, Ellis sounded untroubled. "The grassroots was designed to give people the right to exercise their voice," he said with a shrug. As he addressed the big donors on the Opportunity of 2010, Ellis's legal status was uncertain, but his acquaintance with politics' senior side was beyond doubt. The donors left Palm Springs optimistic about 2010, inspired by Noble and the other members of his panel, but their elation over killing Obamacare soon proved premature. The assumption in Washington and everywhere else was that when they got Scott Brown, it was the death knell for health care, Axelrod recalled. The guy who wouldn't accept that was Obama. He said, "We're going to do this underground and find a path." The Democrats eventually came up with a plan to get the bill through. The House would approve the version that had already passed the Senate with 60 votes in December. Then the Senate would use a parliamentary maneuver that would require only 51 votes to add modifications, circumventing the threat of a Republican filibuster. Despite widespread skepticism, by mid-March, the tenacious House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, was on the verge of success. As passage looked increasingly likely, Tea Party protests grew ever more ugly. Behind them, invisible to the public, was the Koch's money. Tim Phillips, the head of Americans for Prosperity, popped up as the organizer of a March 16th Kill the Bill protest on Capitol Hill, at which he accused the Democrats of trying to cram this 2,000-page bill down the throat of the American people. At a second Capitol Hill rally a few days later, protesters spat on a passing Democratic congressman, mocked Barney Frank, a gay representative from Massachusetts, in lisping catcalls as a faggot, and shouted racist epithets at three black congressmen, John Lewis, Emanuel Cleaver, and Jim Clyburn. Nonetheless, on March 21st, amid mounting excitement, the House's scoreboard registered 216 votes for Obama's Affordable Care Act, the exact number needed to pass the legislation. Spontaneous chants of "Yes, we can" and "Yes, we did" on the House floor evoked election night euphoria. That night, Obama and his staff held a rare celebration on the Truman balcony of the White House, but the president suspected political payback wasn't going to wait long. As he raised a champagne flute to his political director, Patrick Gaspard, he cracked, "You know they're going to kick our asses over this." Downtown, in the Washington office space that Sean Noble shared with several other Koch operatives, Obama's premonitions proved correct. Shortly after the House passed the Affordable Care Act, Noble and his partners studied the vote numbers closely. The glimmer of a new plan formed. They agreed that what they had to do now was to take the political organization they had built to fight the health care plan and use it to take over the legislative body that had just given Obama his greatest victory. "We made a deliberate recommendation that you gotta focus on the House," Noble later told National Review. "That's where this bill passed. Pelosi broke so many arms of Democrats that had no business voting for that bill. Obamacare clearly was the watershed moment that provided the juice to deliver the majority back to the Republicans in the House. Few knew it, but for all intents and purposes, a midterm election like no other had begun. Noble spent most of April on the road, talking with Charles Koch, Rich Fink, Randy Kendrick, and others in the network to plan the operational details. David Koch was more of an afterthought, or, as one participant put it, he was very much the younger brother. Charles, who was methodical and deliberate, pressed the planners closely. The Koch network had grown so big that it took weeks just to touch base with its many donors. All across the country, millionaire by millionaire, Noble made his pitch. They've had their vote, the argument went. Now it's time for some accountability. Fundraising for Noble's group, the Center to Protect Patient Rights, quadrupled by the end of 2010 to $61.8 million. As with all such social welfare groups, under the tax code, the sources of its funding didn't have to be publicly disclosed. The same held true for another mysterious Koch-tied group, something called the TC4 Trust, which raised an additional $42.7 million that year. About a third of this was steered back into the Center to Protect Patient Rights through a method disguised on disclosure forms. This brought Sean Noble's kitty up to almost $75 million. Flush with cash, the Kochs finally had a political operation commensurate with their wealth. Previously, they had given relatively small amounts to 501c4 social welfare groups. Before Citizens United, these non-profit corporations, like for-profit corporations, had been restricted from spending money for or against candidates in elections. Some skirted the law by running what they claimed were issue ads, but legal danger hovered. After Citizens United, though, the Koch-topus essentially sprouted a second set of tentacles. The first cluster was the think tanks, academic programs, legal centers, and issue advocacy organizations that Fink had described as the ideological production line. These ventures were defined for legal purposes as charities and were still prohibited from participating in politics. Donations to them were tax deductible. Added to this in 2010 was a second cluster, a dizzying maze of social welfare groups that dispersed hidden money into the midterm elections. When Congress created the legal framework for social welfare groups almost a century earlier, it never anticipated that they would become a means by which the rich would hide their political spending. In fact, to qualify as tax-exempt, such groups had to certify that they would be operated exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. The IRS later loosened the guidelines, though, allowing them to engage marginally in politics so long as it wasn't their primary purpose. Lawyers soon stretched the loophole to absurd lengths. They argued, for instance, that if a group spent 49% of its funds on politics, it complied with the law because it still wasn't primarily engaged in politics. They also argued that one such group could claim no political spending if it gave to another such group, even if the latter spent the funds on politics. Experts likened the setup to Russian nesting dolls. For example, at the end of 2010, the Center to Protect Patient Rights reported on its tax return that it spent no money on politics, yet it granted $103 million to other conservative groups, most of which were actively engaged in the midterm elections. The Kochs were part of a national explosion of dark money. In 2006, only 2% of outside political spending came from social welfare groups that hid their donors. In 2010, this number rose to 40%, masking hundreds of millions of dollars. Campaign finance reformers were apoplectic but powerless. The political players who are soliciting these funds and are benefiting from the expenditure of these funds will know where the money came from, argued Paul S. Ryan, senior counsel at the liberal Campaign Legal Center. The only ones in the dark will be American voters. Managing all of this new dark money was a challenge. In April, as campaign professionals were trying to figure out how to take maximum advantage of the Citizens United decision, Gillespie invited Republican operatives to what he described in an email as an informal discussion of the 2010 landscape. The unusual meeting was to take place in Carl Rove's living room on Weaver Terrace, a well-off enclave of Northwest Washington. Some joked that they attended the first meeting of what came to be known as the Weaver Terrace Group simply so they could tell friends they had been inside the home of the storied political guru. What transpired was a war council in which the 20 assembled chieftains coordinated their plans of action and divided up their territory. Kenneth Vogel in Big Money describes it as the birthplace of a new Republican Party, one steered by just a handful of unelected operatives who answered only to the richest activists who funded them. Two organizations soon emerged as virtual private banks run by these operatives. The first, American Crossroads, and its 501c4 wing, Crossroads GPS, was initiated by Rove. For funds, it drew heavily on his network of Texas tycoons. The second was Noble's Center to Protect Patient Rights, which began to fill with donations from the Koch donor summits. Working closely with both was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which spent millions of dollars more in undisclosed contributions from businesses, much of it aimed at defeating Obama's Health Care Act. The chamber sent top officials to both the Weaver Terrace meetings and the Koch donor summits. Each of the players' roles was carefully differentiated. Noble focused on House races, leaving the Senate to Rove's group. In accordance with his red map strategy, Gillespie continued to concentrate on governorships and state legislatures. To hide their hands, the operatives steered the funds to a plethora of obscure, smaller groups. This also helped satisfy the legal requirement that no single public welfare group spend more than half of its funds on elections. Soon, to the unschooled eye, a rash of spontaneous attacks on Democrats appeared to be breaking out all across the country. In reality, the effort was so centrally coordinated, as one participant put it, there wasn't one race in which there were multiple groups airing ads at the same time. As Noble explained his methodology later to Eliana Johnson, Washington editor for the conservative publication National Review, he started by producing an Excel spreadsheet. It listed 64 Democratic congressmen in order of the likelihood of their defeat. By the end of June, he said, the list of targets grew to 88, and by August, 105. He assigned each congressional district a win potential of between 1 and 5, and each candidate a score of 1 to 40, based on the voting record of each member and the composition of the district, among other things. Eventually, he said, he sorted the 105 targeted candidates into 3 tiers based on the likelihood of a GOP victory. He then dispersed the Koch network's money in accordance with what he regarded as each candidate's odds of winning. Rather than disclose that his organization was paying for the ads, he directed the money through an array of different front groups. For instance, Noble explained to National Review that he chose a group called the 60 Plus Association, which was a right-wing version of the senior citizens lobby AARP, to air attack ads on Democrats in Arizona's 1st Congressional District, Florida's 2nd and 24th, Indiana's 2nd, Minnesota's 8th, New York's 20th, Ohio's 16th, Pennsylvania's 3rd, and Wisconsin's 3rd and 8th Congressional Districts. Meanwhile, he said he used another group, Americans for Job Security, the same business league he had deployed in the Scott Brown race, to air ads in New York's 24th, North Carolina's 2nd and 8th, Ohio's 18th, and Virginia's 9th congressional districts. He chose the other shadow group that he had used in the Brown race, the Iowa-based American Future Fund, to air attack ads in Alabama's 2nd, Colorado's 7th, New Mexico's 1st, and Washington's 2nd congressional districts. The American Future Fund, like Noble's own nonprofit group, was a 501c4 social welfare group meaning it could hide the identity of its donors and was not supposed to be primarily engaged in electoral politics. Its stated mission was to provide Americans with a conservative and free market viewpoint. In reality, though, it appeared to be little more than a front group acting as a screen for conservative political money. Efforts to track down its office led only to a post office box in Iowa. Founded in 2008 by a Republican operative in the state, it received seed money from one of the country's largest ethanol producers, Bruce Rastetter. But tax records showed that 87% of its funds in 2009 and approximately half its funds in 2010 came from just one source, Sean Noble's Center to Protect Patient Rights. Similarly, Americans for Job Security, a 501c6 business league or trade association, was also entitled under the tax code to hide its funders, who were classified as members. The organization had a physical office in Alexandria, Virginia, but the premises were almost empty. It had only one employee, a 25-year-old Republican campaign aide who was acquainted with Sean Noble. Founded in 1997 with a $1 million donation from the insurance industry, the organization had been accused of being nothing more than a sham front group by Public Citizen, a liberal group that favored tighter campaign finance regulations. State officials in Alaska, where Americans for Job Security had waged an earlier campaign, concluded that the group has no purpose other than to cover various money trails all over the country. The state charged the organization with violating Alaska's fair election rules. The group paid a $20,000 settlement but admitted no guilt. But in 2010, with Noble's help, its business was booming. Noble's center would steer this group $4.8 million that year. In addition, Noble directed millions of dollars into other races through those and other groups, including the anti-tax activist Grover Norquist's organization, Americans for Tax Reform, Howard Rich's group, Americans for Limited Government, and the Koch's flagship organization, Americans for Prosperity. The budget for Americans for Prosperity soared accordingly. In 2004, the budget for the Koch's flagship group and its foundation was $2 million. By 2008, it had grown to $15.2 million, and in 2010, it reached $40 million, engorged with funds from the Center to Protect Patient Rights. In June, Noble tested out the system, using Americans for Prosperity to launch an assault on Tom Perriello, the freshman Democratic congressman from Charlottesville, Virginia, who had defied the fossil fuel interests over the cap-and-trade bill. Noble wanted to start unusually early in order to widen the field of Democrats he could weaken. In an exuberant moment, Perriello had called the climate change fight a gift, proclaiming, "For the first time in a generation, we have the chance to redefine our energy economy." Instead, it was he who got redefined that summer by a barrage of negative ads paid for, not by his opponent, but by unrecognizable outsiders. Perriello was an outspoken liberal in a swing district, so an obvious target. But soon mystery money was tarring Rick Boucher, too, a conservative Democratic congressman whose rural Virginia district encompassed Saltville, the factory town that the Olin Corporation had turned into a toxic waste dump. Boucher had represented the district for 28 years in the House and 8 more before that in the state Senate. A Virginia lawyer and strong ally of business interests, he had been crucial to passage of the cap-and-trade bill in the House, drafting much of the measure and then winning support for it from a number of huge energy firms, including Duke Energy. He had given away so many goodies to the coal industry while negotiating the bill that many environmentalists had been disgusted. Nonetheless, the fact that he had supported the bill at all had angered conservative extremists, including several Virginia coal barons active in funding the Koch network. He was exactly the kind of centrist that big, polarized political money was rendering extinct. "The Koch brothers went after me literally 24/7, recalled Boucher, who after his defeat that November became a partner at the law firm Sidley Austin. By election day, he recalled, he was reeling from $2 million spent against him by Americans for Prosperity and other conservative outside groups. "This is Appalachia," he said. "It's a cheap media market. That would have been like $10 million most other places." He said his Republican opponent, Morgan Griffith, actually didn't raise and spend much, but he didn't have to, because the Koch groups carried his water. Griffith's only issue was his opposition to addressing climate change and other environmental problems, according to Boucher. Griffith's victory left Saltville, where the EPA had forced the Olin Corporation to take responsibility for remediating a river that was still too toxic to fish, represented by a congressman who painted the EPA as the district's greatest foe. In Boucher's view, the polluters had triumphed by overturning the campaign finance laws. "There was a huge change after Citizens United," he contends. "When anyone could spend any amount of money without revealing who they were, by hiding behind amorphous-named organizations, the floodgates opened. The Supreme Court made a huge mistake. There is no accountability. Zero." To shape the midterm message, Noble turned back to the pollster Frank Luntz for market testing. The Center to Protect Patient Rights paid for polls in 100 congressional districts, often multiple times. The help did not come cheap. Records later showed that CPPR spent over $10 million in 2010 on communications and surveys. After conducting focus groups, Luntz suggested that opponents needed to avoid direct attacks on Obama, who was still popular, and instead tied Democratic candidates to Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. "She was totally toxic," one insider on the project said. "People saw her as so San Francisco, so out of touch. Their verbatims, unedited comments, about her were hilarious." To make the anticipated attack ads, Noble again chose Larry McCarthy, the veteran media consultant who was known for his ability to distill a complicated subject into a simple, potent, and usually negative symbol. McCarthy had a reputation for being a particularly shrewd consumer of O, or opposition research on the rival candidates he was targeting. He often honed his ads using polls, focus groups, micro-targeting data, and perception analyzers, meters that evaluated viewers' split-second reactions to demo tapes. McCarthy was an old hand at making disreputable ads for outside groups that wanted to be seen as unrelated to the candidates for reasons of legal and political hygiene. By saying the ads were independent expenditures, candidates got deniability. The Willie Horton ad, for instance, had been paid for by an outside group run by the right-wing operative who founded Citizens United, Floyd Brown. It was the same group that later made the film attacking Hillary Clinton and that gave its name to the corporate speech test case. "Larry is not just one of the best ad makers these days," Brown attested. "He's one of the best advertising minds this century. You go into a studio with Larry and you're watching art. It's beautiful," he said, laughing. "From my standpoint, it's beautiful." Jeff Guerin, a Democratic pollster who had occasionally worked in the past with McCarthy, but who was far more accustomed to being on the other side, was less effusive. He described McCarthy as a serial offender who had played a pretty big part in lowering the bar on what is acceptable in American politics. Shortly before the Kochs held their second summit of the year, a June get-together at the St. Regis Resort in Aspen, they got a break that enormously increased their network's financial clout when House Democrats passed a bill, backed by President Obama, to eliminate the so-called carried interest loophole. The idea of eliminating the special tax break enjoyed by private equity and hedge fund managers struck fear in the finance industry. Obama had won the support of a surprisingly large share of New York's finance titans in 2008, but his stance on the tax, which would never make it through the Senate, enraged many of its heaviest hitters. Stephen Schwarzman, the chairman and CEO of the enormously lucrative private equity firm The Blackstone Group, whose personal fortune Forbes then estimated at $6.5 billion, would call the administration's efforts to close the loophole a war, claiming it was like when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939. Schwarzman later apologized for the remark, but in truth, the relationship between Obama and Wall Street had begun deteriorating almost as soon as he took office. Financiers resented being blamed for the collapse of the economy in 2008. They took extreme umbrage when Obama had chastised them as fat cats, and they claimed that his administration was run by college professors who knew nothing about business. But Schwarzman and a number of other financiers regarded this as a new level of affront and flocked to the June Koch summit with their checkbooks in hand, determined to prevent his re-election. Ironically, it was probably Schwarzman's own excesses that had brought the carried interest loophole to critics' attention. In 2006, when he decided to transform Blackstone from a private partnership into a public company, he had been required to disclose his earnings for the first time. The numbers stunned both Wall Street and Washington. He made $398.3 million in 2006, which was nine times more than the CEO of Goldman Sachs. On top of this, his shares in Blackstone were valued at more than $7 billion. A 2008 New Yorker profile by James B. Stewart quotes a friend of Schwarzman saying, "You have no idea what an impression this made on Wall Street. You have all these guys who have spent their entire lives working just as hard to make $20 million. Sure, that's a lot of money, but then Schwarzman turns around and, seemingly overnight, has $8 billion." Beyond this, Stewart wrote, Schwarzman made himself an easy target for critics of Wall Street greed and conspicuous consumption with an expanding collection of trophy residences that are lavish even by the current standards of Wall Street. A 2007 Wall Street Journal profile also described how, at one of Schwarzman's five houses, an 11,000-square-foot home in Palm Beach, Florida, he complained to Jean-Pierre Zugin, his executive chef and estate manager, that an employee wasn't wearing the proper black shoes with his uniform. He found the squeak of the rubber soles distracting. His own mother told the paper that money is what drives him. Money is the measuring stick. Schwarzman's most serious self-inflicted wound, though, was the $3 million 60th birthday party he threw for himself in February 2007, at which he paid pop stars Rod Stewart and Patti LaBelle to serenade him. The media sensation stirred by the billionaire bacchanal led directly to congressional calls to close the carried interest loophole. The loophole was, in essence, an accounting trick that enabled hedge fund and private equity managers to categorize huge portions of their income as interest, which was taxed at the 15% rate, then applied to long-term capital gains. This was less than half the income tax rate paid by other top bracket wage earners. Critics called the loophole a gigantic subsidy to millionaires and billionaires at the expense of ordinary taxpayers. The Economic Policy Institute, a progressive think tank, estimated that the hedge fund loophole cost the government over $6 billion a year, the cost of providing health care to 3 million children. Of that total, it said, almost $2 billion a year from the tax break went to just 25 individuals. Congressional critics had been trying to close the loophole since at least 2007, but while the Democratic House had passed reform bills three times, the measures always died in the Senate, the victim of both Republican and Democratic protectors beholden to Wall Street. With the issue back in play in the summer of 2010, the financiers were again mobilizing. As Clifford S. Ness, who ran a hedge fund in Greenwich, Connecticut, had declared in a call to arms when Obama first started speaking critically of hedge fund speculators and fat cats, hedge funds really need a community organizer. Organizers were waiting for Schwarzman and others at the June Koch summit, the theme of which was understanding and addressing threats to American free enterprise and prosperity. The financiers represented a different strain of the Republican Party from the Kochs. Few were fanatically ideological. Most were simply concerned with protecting their continued accumulation of wealth. But when their resources were combined with the idea machinery built by the conservative movement's early funders, along with the ideological zealotry of the Kochs and other anti-government radicals, the result was a raging river of cash capable of carrying the whole Republican Party to the right. Another hedge fund manager who attended the Aspen session was the former Obama bundler Ken Griffin, founder and CEO of the Chicago-based hedge fund Citadel, whose shift from a Democratic bundler for Obama to the Republican side was part of what came to be known as the hedge fund switch. Other billionaire financiers at the event included the Home Depot founder turned investment banker Ken Langone and the Massachusetts-based private equity investor John Childs. Childs was the second in command at Thomas H. Lee Partners when it made $900 million in 2 years in a leveraged buyout deal for the beverage company Snapple. His own company, J.W. Childs Associates, had ups and downs, but he had been a consistently huge investor in conservative politics, once described as the closest thing the Republican Party has to an automatic teller machine in Massachusetts. In the 2010 election cycle, Childs would go on to spend $907,000 on federal elections. The hedge fund manager Paul Singer, chairman of the Manhattan Institute and a major contributor to the Republican Party, didn't attend, but his close aide, Annie Dickerson, appeared on his behalf. Singer's company, Elliott Management, had a unique niche in the financial world. It bought the distressed debt of bankrupt companies and countries and then demanded to be paid in full or, if necessary, took them to court. Critics had called the tactic immoral, particularly when applied to impoverished countries, castigating him as a vulture capitalist who profited off poverty. But Singer had accumulated a fortune estimated at $900 million from the practice. Singer, who described himself as a Goldwater free enterprise conservative, was a supporter of gay rights, but a harsh critic of the Obama administration's proposed financial regulatory reforms. Furious with the Democrats, he hosted his own fundraiser in Manhattan for Republican candidates opposing Dodd-Frank and other financial reforms that summer. He also attended a similar meeting at the $14 million home of another disgruntled hedge fund donor, Steve Cohen of SAC Capital. According to later reports, this small and intensely wealthy circle of billionaire moguls soon pumped at least $10 million into groups boosting Republicans in the midterms, often without any public trace. The concentration of wealth at the Koch summit by this point was extraordinary. Of the 200 or so participants meeting secretly with the Kochs in Aspen that June, at least 11 were on Forbes' list of the 400 wealthiest Americans. The combined assets of this group alone, assessed in accordance with the magazine's estimates of their wealth at the time, amounted to $129.1 billion. Hoping to inspire their generosity, Noble previewed a sample television ad for the donors, slamming Obamacare, as well as touting the Republicans' chances of winning on a panel titled Mobilizing Citizens for November. Is there a chance this fall to elect leaders who are more strongly committed to freedom and prosperity? The brochure for the discussion asked. This session will further assess the landscape and offer a plan to educate voters on the importance of economic freedom. Joining Noble on the panel was Tim Phillips, the president of Americans for Prosperity, who unveiled his group's plan to spend an unheard-of $45 million on a few targeted midterm races. In the evening, conference-goers were treated to a rousing dinner speech from the Fox News host Glenn Beck, titled, in homage to Hayek, "Is America on the Road to Serfdom?" Finally, topping off the night was a cocktails and dessert reception hosted by Donors Trust. Whitney Ball, the head of the organization that offered donors a politically safe way to give big and anonymously, later explained her attendance at the event succinctly: "It's a target-rich environment." On the final day, the donors engaged in auction-like bids over lunch, one-upping each other with their seven-figure pledges amid laughter and applause. Charles and David Koch themselves reportedly pledged $12 million. By the end of the meal, the Coke-backed nonprofits could count on $25 million more in the kitty. By July, Democratic strategists began to feel a strange undertow, as if an offshore tsunami were gathering force. One operative put together a chart compiling the pledged midterm expenditures by 10 Republican-aligned independent groups and was appalled to discover that this slice of the total spending alone would likely reach at least $200 million. Americans for Prosperity had pledged to spend $45 million. Karl Rove's group, American Crossroads, had pledged $52 million. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce had committed to spend $75 million. Countless other groups, including an unknown number of dark money organizations loaded with secret funds, were lined up to spend millions and millions more. A Democratic operative who saw the chart, which was passed around like a samizdat within the party, admitted that it was one hell of a wake-up call. The numbers caught the Obama administration off guard. The former White House aide, Anita Dunn, admits, "It was clear that Citizens United was going to open the floodgates, and it would be bad for the Democrats. But it exploded in 2010. The amount spent in those midterms probably surprised everyone." As late as May, Axelrod had barely known who the Kochs were. When a reporter asked what he knew about them, he seemed unsure. Later, the Koch public relations team would suggest that press coverage of them was initiated by the White House. In truth, Obama's political team was almost clueless. Only after Noble's team, working undercover, began launching attacks on Democrats all across the country, did some in the White House start to sense something odd. As Axelrod recalls, "We began to wonder, where is all this money coming from?" In Iowa, the American Future Fund began airing an ad created by Larry McCarthy that Jeff Garin, the Democratic pollster, described as perhaps the most egregious of the year. The ad accused the then-Congressman Bruce Braley, an Iowa Democrat and a lawyer, of supporting a proposed Islamic community center in Lower Manhattan, which it misleadingly called a mosque at ground zero. As footage of the destroyed World Trade Center rolled, a narrator said, "For centuries, Muslims built mosques where they won military victories. Now, it said a mosque celebrating 9/11 was to be built on the very spot where Islamic terrorists killed 3,000 Americans. It was, the narrator suggested, as if the Japanese were to build a triumphal monument at Pearl Harbor." The ad then accused Braley of supporting the mosque. In fact, Braley had taken no position on the issue. No surprise for a congressman from Iowa, but an unidentified video cameraman had ambushed him at the Iowa State Fair and asked him about it. Braley replied that he regarded the matter as a local zoning issue for New Yorkers to decide. Soon afterward, he says, the attack ad dropped on me like the house in The Wizard of Oz. Braley, who won his seat by a margin of 30% in 2008, barely held on in 2010. The American Future Fund's effort against Braley was the most expensive campaign that year by an independent group. After the election, Braley accused McCarthy, the ad maker, of profiting from Citizens United in the lowest way. As for those who hired McCarthy, he said they are laughing all the way to the bank. It's a good investment for them. They're the winners. The losers are the American people and the truth. In North Carolina, Congressman Bob Etheridge, a seven-term Democrat, fared worse. He was the target of ads made by McCarthy for another of Noble's front groups, Americans for Job Security. That summer, Etheridge was walking on Capitol Hill when he, too, found himself the victim of a video ambush. Two young men in suits approached him. One thrust a video camera in his face, while the other demanded to know, "Do you fully support the Obama agenda?" Taken aback, Etheridge asked, "Who are you?" When he got no answer, he asked again. Growing irate, he repeated the question five times until finally he pushed the camera away and gripped his inquisitor. "Please let go of my arm, Congressman," the inquisitor pleaded as the camera kept recording. "Who are you?" Etheridge repeated. Finally, the interviewer stammered, I'm just a student, sir. From? Etheridge asked. The streets, came the answer. Within days, a video of the confrontation, edited to make Etheridge seem unhinged, was posted on the conservative website Big Government under the headline, Congressman Attacks Student. It went viral. Soon afterward, McCarthy inserted the video into an attack ad titled, Who Are You?, in which people purporting to be from Etheridge's district answered, We're your constituents, and then accused Etheridge, inaccurately, of wanting to cut Medicare. As per Luntz's instructions, Nancy Pelosi figured prominently in the ads as well. The spot that dealt the death blow to Etheridge, finally, was one that accused him, like Braley, of supporting the Ground Zero Mosque. The local television station, WRAL-TV in Raleigh, which covered the campaign, noted that Americans for Job Security had spent $360,000 on media against Etheridge, but at the time, no one was able to figure out who was behind the group. After a 17-day recount, Etheridge lost in November in a stunning upset to a Tea Party sympathizer, Renee Elmers, who was a nurse running with the support of Sarah Palin. The next day, the National Republican Congressional Committee, NRCC, which had previously denied any role, acknowledged that it had been behind the ambush video. How the video made its way into the independent ad was never revealed, but the NRCC, too, was one of McCarthy's clients. It was not a coincidence that Braley, Etheridge, Perriello, and other Democrats were all ambushed that year by unidentified videographers. In 2010, Americans for Prosperity and several other conservative groups encouraged members to provoke Democratic candidates into on-camera outbursts. Some gave instructions on how to do it. In time, the practice spread to liberal groups, too. The Internet had exponentially increased the power of viral videos, particularly those capturing compromising behavior. Aiding the effort, several of the wealthiest members of the Koch network launched media ventures during this period, widening the exposure for partisan attacks. Foster Fries, the Wyoming mutual fund magnate, for instance, committed to spend $3 million to found The Daily Caller in 2010 after a single luncheon conversation about it with Tucker Carlson, its prospective editor-in-chief. The online news venture described itself as a conservative version of The Huffington Post. In fact, it functioned more as an outlet for opposition research paid for by the donor class. Charles Koch's foundation would later also back the news site. After The New Yorker published my investigative article on the Kochs, covert operations, that August, The Daily Caller was the chosen receptacle for the retaliatory opposition research on me, although after it proved false, the website decided not to run it. Only in 2011 did it surface that in New York, at least, the Ground Zero Mosque controversy had been stirred up for political gain in part by money from Robert Mercer, the co-CEO of the $15 billion Long Island hedge fund Renaissance Technologies. To aid a conservative candidate in New York, Mercer gave $1 million to help pay for ads attacking supporters of the Ground Zero Mosque. A former computer programmer who had a reputation as a brilliant mathematician and an eccentric loner, Mercer was a relative newcomer to the Koch summits, but he was immediately impressed by the organization. He had long held the government in low regard and shared the Koch's antipathy toward government regulations. In addition to fanning flames around the mosque issue, in 2010, Mercer reportedly gave over $300,000 to a super PAC trying to defeat a Democratic congressman from Oregon, Pete DeFazio, who had proposed taxing stock trades. Renaissance, a so-called quant fund, traded stocks in accordance with computer algorithms at enormously high frequencies and volumes, so the proposed tax would have bitten into the firm's legendary profits. Someone familiar with Mercer's thinking maintained that the proposed tax on stock trades was not behind his involvement in the race. Rather, Mercer shared deep skepticism about global warming with the Republican candidate Arthur Robinson. Instead of openly debating these issues, though, Mercer, who declined to speak about his motivations, paid for ads that manipulated voters' fears about terrorism and Medicare. As the congressional races grew nasty, Gillespie's Republican State Leadership Committee began to channel dark money into one local state legislature race after another. There were furtive, well-coordinated projects to take over the state houses in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and elsewhere. North Carolina, in particular, was living up to its promise as a perfect testing ground for the Red Map strategy. Art Pope's outsized role there, meanwhile, was also providing an instructive demonstration of how much influence one extraordinarily wealthy activist could have over a single state in the post-Citizens United era. Many of the details remained shrouded from public view, but that fall, in the remote western corner of North Carolina, John Snow, a retired Democratic judge who had represented the district in the state Senate for three terms, found himself subjected to one political attack after another. Snow, who often voted with the Republicans, was considered one of the most conservative Democrats in the General Assembly, and his record reflected the views of his constituents. His Republican opponent, Jim Davis, an orthodontist loosely allied with the Tea Party, had minimal political experience, and Snow, a former college football star, was expected to be reelected easily. Yet somehow, Davis seemed to have almost unlimited money with which to assail Snow. Snow recalls, "I voted to help build a pier with an aquarium on the coast, as did every other member of the North Carolina House and Senate who voted. But a television attack ad presented the luxury pier as Snow's wasteful scheme. We've lost jobs, an actress said in the ad. John Snow's solution for our economy? Go fish. A mass mailing, decorated with a cartoon pig, denounced the pier as one of Snow's pork projects. In all, Snow says, he was the target of 24 mass mailings, one of them reminiscent of the Willie Horton ad. It featured a photograph of a menacing-looking African-American convict who, it said, thanks to arrogant State Senator John Snow, could soon be let off death row. Snow, in fact, supported the death penalty and had prosecuted murder cases. But in 2009, Snow had helped pass a new state law, the Racial Justice Act, that enabled judges to reconsider a death sentence if a convict could prove that the jury's verdict had been tainted by racism. The law was an attempt to address the overwhelming racial disparity in capital sentences. The attacks just went on, Snow later recalled. My opponents used fear tactics. I'm a moderate, but they tried to make me look liberal. On election night, he lost by an agonizingly slim margin, fewer than 200 votes. After the election, the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, a nonpartisan pro-business organization, revealed that two seemingly independent outside political groups had spent several $100,000 on ads against Snow, a huge amount for a local race in a poor backwoods district. Pope was instrumental in funding both groups, Civitas Action and Real Jobs NC. In fact, Pope gave $200,000 in seed money in 2010 to start Real Jobs NC, which was responsible for the Go Fish ad and the mass mailing that attacked Snow's pork projects. Real Jobs NC was also the recipient of a whopping $1.25 million from Ed Gillespie's Republican State Leadership Committee. But as the investigative news outfit ProPublica explained, Gillespie's group distributed its contributions in a way designed to hide its involvement from voters. Instead of putting its own name on the ads, it created new, local-sounding nonprofit groups that lacked the word Republican. As a social welfare organization, it claimed to be non-political, yet its funds were used to attack 20 different Democrats around the state, and no Republicans. Bob Phillips, the head of the North Carolina chapter of Common Cause, an organization that promotes stricter controls on political money, watched the unfolding drama closely and concluded that the Citizens United decision was an even bigger game changer at the local level than at the national. He said it enabled a single donor, particularly one with access to major corporate funds like Pope or the Kochs, to play a significant and even decisive role. We didn't have that before 2010, Phillips says. Citizens United opened up the door. Now a candidate can literally be outspent by independent groups. We saw it in North Carolina, and a lot of the money was traced back to Art Pope. In fact, misleading attack ads sponsored by the same unknown outside groups popped up in local races all over the state. In Fayetteville, Margaret Dixon, a 61-year-old pro-business Democrat who was seeking re-election to the North Carolina State Senate, was depicted as a clone of Nancy Pelosi, even though her record was considerably more conservative. Another ad, funded by her opponent, made her look like a hooker, she said, showing a doppelganger applying lipstick and taking piles of greenbacks and suggesting she was prostituting her state job for money. Pope later said he was appalled by the ad, but Americans for Prosperity, on whose board he sat, promoted her opponent. Those ads hurt me, she said later. I've been through this 4 times before, but the tone of this campaign was much uglier and much more personal than anything I've seen. On election night, Dixon fell about 1,000 votes short of victory in her district, which has a population of more than 150,000. Chris Haggerty, a Democratic lawyer who ran for a legislative seat that fall in Raleigh, had previously directed an election reform group and was not naive about political money. Yet even he was caught off guard by the intensity of the effort marshaled against him. Real Jobs NC and Civitas Action spent some $70,000 on ads portraying him as fiscally profligate, while Americans for Prosperity spent heavily on behalf of his opponent. One ad accused him of having voted to raise taxes over $1 billion, even though he had not yet served in the legislature. He said, "If you put all of the Pope groups together, they and the North Carolina GOP spent more to defeat me than the guy who actually won." He fell silent, then added, "For an individual to have so much power is frightening. The government of North Carolina is for sale." Pope, who regarded himself as an underdog in a historically Democratic state and an honest reformer, took umbrage at such talk. "People throw around terms like so-and-so tried to buy the election," he said in an interview, but in his view, that evoked bribery, and "that's illegal, corrupt, and something I've fought hard against in North Carolina." He said the money he spent simply helped educate citizens so that they could make informed decisions. It's the core of the First Amendment. Asked whether those with more cash might drown out less wealthy voices, he said, "I really have more faith in North Carolina voters than that." Martin Nesbitt Jr., the Democratic leader in the North Carolina Senate, wasn't convinced. Of Pope's 2010 spending, he said, "It wasn't an education, it was an onslaught. What he's doing is buying elections." Other critics accused Pope of using tax-deductible philanthropic pursuits to promote aggressively pro-business, anti-tax policies that helped his company. Scholars who worked at a think tank funded by his family foundations, for instance, opposed any raise in the minimum wage and, in fact, any minimum wage laws at all. At the same time, many employees at Pope's discount stores were paid the minimum wage. "I am careful to comply with the law," Pope argued, "and I keep my personal activities separate from my philanthropic, public policy, grassroots, and independent expenditure efforts." He protested caricatures that portrayed him as greedy and self-serving, saying he deeply cared about the people of North Carolina, but believed they were better served by private enterprise than government social programs. He therefore believed in cutting personal and corporate income taxes, abolishing estate taxes, and cutting state spending. Friends explained that Pope believed it was the role of charities, to which he contributed, not the government, to look after the poor and disadvantaged. The Pope fortune was highly dependent on low-income patrons. In 1930, Pope's grandfather established 5 small dime stores in North Carolina that he sold to the next generation. Pope's father was a tough and thrifty merchant who expanded the family business into an empire spanning 13 states. Pope then worked his way up in the company, becoming CEO. Variety Wholesalers owned several chains, including Roses, Maxway, Super 10, and Bargain Town. The company favored a specific demographic, neighborhoods with median incomes of less than $40,000 a year, and populations that were at least 25% African American. Despite the controversy it stirred, the triumph of Pope and outside money in North Carolina in 2010 was sweeping. Of 22 local legislative races targeted by Pope, his family, and their organizations, the Republicans won 18. As Gillespie and he had hoped, this placed both chambers of the General Assembly firmly under Republican majorities for the first time since 1870. According to the Institute for Southern Studies, three-quarters of the spending by independent groups in North Carolina's 2010 state races came from accounts linked to Pope. The total amount that Pope and his family and groups backed by him spent, $2.2 million, was not that much by national standards, but was enough to exert crucial influence within the confines of one state. The pattern did in fact repeat itself all across the nation. The Obama team has done some amazing things. Those guys are really something. But the Democrats plain got skunked on the state houses. The former Republican Congressman Tom Reynolds, the chairman of Red Map, later told Politico. Gillespie's deputy, Chris Jankowski, later admitted, "At first I was a little panicked. They weren't out there really competing. I thought I was going to get hit by a sucker punch. But then," he said, "I realized what was happening, and it was like, how much can we run up the score?" In the final month before the midterm elections, Obama's political advisors realized there was almost nothing they could do to prevent disaster. "We lost all hope in October," one White House aide later admitted. "We didn't feel much of anything. We just had to let the ship hit the iceberg." In a last-ditch effort, Obama tried to warn voters that Republicans were trying to steal the elections with secret, special interest cash. He began speaking out on the campaign about how Citizens United had allowed a flood of deceptive attack ads sponsored by special interests using front groups with misleading names. He even made a barely veiled reference to the Kochs, suggesting that big companies were hiding behind groups with harmless-sounding names like Americans for Prosperity. Obama said, "They don't have to say who exactly Americans for Prosperity are. You don't know if it's a foreign-controlled corporation, or even," he added, "a big oil company." In the final days before the election, the Democratic Party aired a national ad accusing Bush cronies Ed Gillespie and Karl Rove and shills for big business of stealing our democracy. The spot depicted an old woman getting mugged. The image, though, was hackneyed and the message simplistic. It was almost impossible to explain to the public in sound bites the connections between the sea of dark money, the donors' financial interests, the assault on Obama's policies, and their lives. The conventional wisdom among professional political consultants was that Americans either didn't get it or just didn't care. It's likely, given historical trends and an unemployment rate topping 9.5%, that a Republican wave in 2010 was inevitable. But the unmatched money from a handful of ultra-rich conservatives helped turn the likely win into a rout. Noble had made so much progress that by the final weeks in the campaign, he was aiming beyond his third-tier candidates at congressmen no one had ever believed were vulnerable. After noticing how little money Jim Oberstar, a Democratic congressman from Duluth, Minnesota, had raised, Noble bought local television time and aired an ad thrown together by McCarthy, casting Oberstar as a disco-era relic who cared more about himself than about his constituents. Oberstar, to almost everyone's surprise, became another notch on Noble's belt. On November 2, 2010, the Democrats suffered massive defeats, losing control of the House of Representatives. Just 2 short years after he soared to power amid predictions of a lasting realignment, Obama's party, and his hopes of prevailing on any ambitious legislation were crushed. Republicans gained 63 seats in the House, putting them firmly in control of the lower body. It was the largest such turnover since 1948. Pelosi, the first female speaker and Luntz's favorite target, was exiled to minority status after only 4 years. The Ohio Republican John Boehner, the new speaker, now had a caucus bursting with Tea Party enthusiasts who had ridden to power by attacking government in general and Obama in particular. Several had won primaries against moderates. Many owed their victories to donors expecting radically conservative change. Compromise wasn't in their interest. The Democrats' setbacks were huge at almost every level. Republicans picked up half a dozen Senate seats. At the state level, the Democratic losses were even more staggering. Across the country, Republicans gained 675 legislative seats. They won control of both the legislature and the governor's office in 21 states. The Democrats had similar one-party rule in only 11. The map looked red, with small islands of blue. As a consequence of their gains, Republicans now had four times as many districts to gerrymander as the Democrats. By creating reliably safe seats, they could build a firewall protecting the Republican control of Congress for the next decade. Clearly, red map's payoff for a relatively modest investment was impressive. For the Republicans, as Glenn Thrush of Politico observed, it became the gift that keeps on giving. Newly Republican states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and North Carolina soon became breeding grounds for attacks on Obama's core agenda. They undermined his policies on health care, abortion, gay rights, voting rights, immigration, the environment, guns, and labor. "It feels bad," Obama admitted at a press conference the day after the election. What hurt especially, he said, was having to make condolence calls to Democrats who had gone out on a limb to defend him and his policies, such as Ohio's governor, Ted Strickland. "The toughest thing in the last couple of days is seeing really terrific public servants not being able to serve more," he said. "There's not only sadness about seeing them go, but there's also a lot of questioning on my part in terms of could I have done something differently or something more?" Waxing professorial, he suggested, "This is something that I think every president needs to go through." But then he paused and joked wanly, "Now, I'm not suggesting for every future president that they take a shellacking like I did last night." One of the biggest, though least known, winners of the evening was Sean Noble. When he had worked as a congressional aide on Capitol Hill, he had earned a salary of $87,000 a year. By contrast, by 2011, he was wealthy enough to make two major real estate purchases, in addition to the two houses that he and his wife owned in Phoenix. He spent $665,000 on a Capitol Hill row house and an undisclosed amount on a 5,700-square-foot, eight-bedroom house in Hurricane Utah, Bloomberg News reported, and best of all, the record spending on the 2012 election was just around the corner.